911, please state the nature of your emergency.
Hello? Can you help me? I have beaten myself to death with a baseball bat.
You sound quite alive to me.
I'm telling you.
What's your name, sir?
Bat Segundo.
You do realize that this is 911. This is an emergency number.
And that's why I'm calling you. This is an emergency.
Do you not like yourself or something?
I guess you tickle me.
Do you know why you would do something like this?
I have no idea. I only know that I am dead and I am trying to come to terms with this regrettable reality.
Have you been drinking?
Well, of course I've been drinking. What else is there to do?
Okay. So I am here with Catherine Harrison at a coffee shop, which cannot be named for legal reasons. Catherine is the author of The Kiss, Envy, The Seal Wife, and most recently, While They Slept, An Inquiry into the Murder of a Family. Welcome, Catherine.
Thank you.
Okay, my first question, I guess appropriately enough, has to do with the way you open the book. And especially considering how personal and memoiristic the book is, you open with a very stark transcript of a 911 call of what had happened with the murders of the Gilley family. I just wondered, one, why did you choose to open the book in this way and feature this, essentially, maybe not verbatim, the transcript, but, you know, pretty much a good representation of what it was?
It is verbatim. It's only a small part of it, but it is verbatim. I worked from a number of documents and sources, and I didn't feel that I could do better than to begin with that exchange between Jody and the 911 operator, because it really showed so much about who she was, you know, the level of her diction, her way of saying, you know, what had happened. You know, I think my father's killed my parents and my sister, and, you know, when did it? And then the 911 operator's incongruously saying, what, did he not like them or something? And she said, well, yeah, I guess. you know, it was an economical way of introducing a number of things that would come up later in the book. And it's pretty compelling, I think.
Yeah, I mean, I was actually going to ask about that exchange where he brings up the, you know, I guess he didn't like your parents. It just struck me as so, where did this come from? It's as if he couldn't process what had happened.
Yeah, that and just the incongruity of it. It had that sort of immediacy that and authenticity that spoke for itself, not the kind of thing that you could... I couldn't have synthesized or summarized anything as eloquent as that tape from the 911 operator. So, and it really just introduced what the book was about. You know, this is a story about a family being murdered.
Was it also a case, too, of, I mean, text can only go so far. I mean, is there something that may be missing because we aren't hearing the actual audio transcript? Like, even with that exchange that we just talked about, you know, are there inflections in Jody's voice of, you know, just being in shock or being in...
Oh, I'm sure. Catatonia? I'm sure. I mean, that would be true of the written word as opposed to the spoken word. It does have annotations about points at which she starts to cry and she hesitates, and you know, I think that some level of panic and disorientation comes through, but it's never going to replace the sound of a voice.
Absolutely. And now to sort of fan out into a more general question, but you talk, you know, a little bit in the early parts of the book of being a fan of true crime books, and that was at least a part of how you ended up writing about this case. And there are a couple of questions I'm going to throw at you. One is the expected, why this case, especially when there are a number of other instances of say, young people murdering their families, or there was a case that I was just reading up on because it was the basis for a recent horror movie that had happened in a very small town in California where a girl had walked in after sleeping over at the cabin next door, and, you know, I think three members of her family had been murdered in a vicious way, but other members of the family were sleeping, and it's still unsolved. So I guess the question is that, you know, first, why the Gilleys?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, a couple of very pragmatic reasons. Access. You know, I'm not a journalist, an investigative journalist, so I don't track crime or police blotters or anything like that. And this was a story that had been told to me in very, very summary, minimal way 10 years earlier. And It's true that I do like reading true crime. I never anticipated writing true crime. That wasn't an ambition of mine to actually create it. But I was speaking on the phone with a friend who told me these very few details about what had happened in the Gilley family, and it just stuck in my head.
Now, how did this friend know about what had happened to the Gilleys? Was there a connection? Or?
Yes. The friend is actually, she is my friend, and she's also my agent. So we were having a conversation. It must be like 13 years ago now, and just, you know, talking about nothing. And she said, "Oh, you know, I just spoke with a really interesting young woman," and I said, "Oh, what was interesting about her?" And she said, "Well, you would have thought that her story was fascinating." And she told me just those few details, that Jody was trying to write a book, a memoir about what had happened in her family. And what had happened was that when she was 16, her 18-year-old brother had killed the rest of the family. And then he wanted to run away with her. That's all I knew. Although I think she said he wanted to run away to Reno with her. and I don't know, there's something about those few facts that just stuck in my head. And because I do like reading true crime, I was looking forward to it. So I asked after it every couple of years. And I think, what happened with that book project by the girl whose brother killed their family? And, you know, my agent said, "Oh, you know, it's not done yet, it's not done yet." And finally, when I asked the question when I was meeting with her and my editor, to discuss a nonfiction project, because according to my contract with Random House, I owed them a nonfiction book, and we were knocking around ideas, and some of them were better than others, but there wasn't like the idea. And apropos of nothing, and not really thinking it had much to do with the conversation at hand, it just popped into my head. I said, "So, you know, whatever happened to that book about the girl whose brother killed their family?" And my agent threw her hands up in her, and she said, "Oh, Jody's never going to get that book written." And I said, "I'll write it." You know, which is how I've gotten myself into fixes before. And, you know, the little voice of reason is saying, "What are you talking about? You know, you don't write true crime. You know, what can you mean?" And yet, it was a very gut level, instinctive, honest response to that. I wanted to know that story, and the only way I was going to find out was to be the person who was going to write it. So, you know, we looked at each other, and my agent said, "Well, that's an interesting idea. I'll talk to Jody." And as it turned out, Jody had tried to write the story herself, tried with a ghostwriter, tried in a number of different ways, and it had always. She had always failed, really, because she could not bear to immerse herself in her past for as long as it would take to write a book. It was simply too painful. She's somebody who has quite carefully and deliberately reconstructed herself and her life to remain on an even keel. And, you know, things fell apart when she started spending all her time thinking about that really cataclysmic event in her youth. So she couldn't do it.
So I guess the question also begs itself is, how is it that, and understandably, but Jody's self-reflection was too much for her to do the project herself, but when she spoke with you, and presumably there was many conversations involved, many emails, even
yes.
some visits.
Yes.
So how was she able to, I guess, get around that compartmentalization?
I think she could do that much. I think that she could have me show up for an afternoon or an evening and hammer at her with questions, and she could answer them, and then I would go away with the material, and then we would follow up with email. And we did that on a number of occasions, and she accompanied me back to Medford, where the murders took place, to sort of give me a tour of all of it. And she put me in touch with her brother, with whom she's not spoken or written to for, you know, for as long as it's happened, I don't know, 20 years. She could do that. And she did it for a reason. One of the reasons she wanted to write the book is that she wanted the story told. She's very much somebody who is focused on wringing some kind of redemption out of making her suffering useful to other people. And she felt that if the story could be told and put out there, that it would raise consciousness just that much that little bit more so that maybe somehow it would save one other family. She was very committed to that idea, and she found it really hard. It was a hard process for her, because I did have to just ask every awful question. And it was a hard process for me because I'm not a journalist. You know, I have a lot of experience in, you know, holding my own hand to the flame, or, you know, rooting around inside my own chest to dig up what I need to. But it's a different thing to inflict that kind of scrutiny and sort of rigorous investigation on somebody else.
What sort of thing struck you as being, say, the hardest part of being an investigator of someone else's life? I mean, as you've now repeatedly said, you're not a journalist, and
right.
yet you had to go through and research and...
Well, I had to speak with two people, one a murderer, about... You know, I had to go to Billy, and I had to talk to him about murdering his mother and his father and his little sister, you know. Blow by blow. No pun intended, or pun intended. You know, what happened? Who did you hit first? How many times? What did you do? What were you thinking? Yeah. And with Jody, I had to go back to that night, too, and say, what did you hear? When did you know he'd killed them? Were you afraid for yourself? What happened? You know, every last detail. So you went down the stairs, and then you turned on the light, and what did you see? And your sister, did you say that she was under the coffee table, and you could still, and was she still breathing? And... You know, your father was on the couch, and, you know, just to really, so that I could have as clear a picture of what happened as possible, I really had to depend on their memories that they mostly didn't want to access. And there were other parts, I think, that were equally difficult for her, even though they weren't about the night of the murder. You know, the family was a deeply troubled family. The parents were very abusive. There were all sorts of boundary issues. There were inappropriate sexual contact among the families. The mother was horrible. The father was horrible. And so we went back to, what do you first remember? You know, what about that time when, you know, your mother beat you for not doing the dishes right? Or how about, let's go over again, when your father propositioned you? You know, stuff that was just ugly, painful. All the stuff that was in the past that Jody had decided to shut the door on, I was making her retrieve and explain. Sometimes four times, because a lot of it was shocking and it was hard for me to get a hold of. And so, I mean, I think I even said in the book at some point, you know, I feel like she must believe that we're having the same painful interview over and over again, because we meet and I ask a question that she's answered before, just because I have to hear the answer again.
But that's actually not so different from a police officer interrogating or a lawyer interrogating.
No, I think it's probably quite similar. The problem was that this was 20 years behind her, and that's where she likes it. You know, she lives on the other side of the country. She's changed her name. Everything about her life now is severed from the life that she had before. And to write the book, I really had to take her back over that cordon sanitaire that she had set up and say, you know, we're gonna have to hang out here together for a while until I get enough information to turn this into a book. That said, however many hours she spent on it was nothing compared to my steeping myself in it for, I mean, it took 3 years. And so she couldn't do that, but she could give me what I needed.
The other thing, too, that struck me in reading this book is you talk about putting together timelines.
Right.
And how you had to put together, I think, five or so, because the first four didn't work. You kept having to add it in. Mm-hmm. And you had to make sure that it all flowed all in one document. So a couple of things. One is, why did it all have to be in this one continuous document instead of just having things here and there and everywhere?
There were other forms that this information took. There was the index card thing, in which I could reorder them and shuffle them, and there were, of course, notebooks and any number of other things. You know, it's a shocking story, and it's hard to get a hold of. And there was a part of me that just needed some representation that showed me in all of a piece, one piece, this happened, and then this happened, and then this happened, and then this happened, and just all the way from the beginning to the end. I needed that. I think for two reasons. One, you know, it's like that is a very human response to dealing with something traumatic. You know, you have to go over it and over it again. It's like on 9/11, where we had to watch the planes crash into the building over and over and over again. We knew what it looked like. We'd seen it before, but you couldn't not look at it again because it took, you know, 10, 15, 50 re-exposures until you actually said, okay, I believe it. And that was the same with this story. I needed to be re-exposed to the pieces. And so I think that, you know, doing the note cards and then making the first timeline and then making the second timeline and the third timeline, it was a way of my saying, of my being able to take possession of something that was, in a psychic way, terribly burdensome and unwieldy. The other thing was that because it wasn't my life, and because I was using interviews from various people to cobble together one story, I needed some sort of method of collating everything so that I could take, you know, Billy's version and her version and the victim services counselor's version and the attorney's version and the police version and come up with one master version that I could work from.
And that also takes into account some of the conflicting statements between Jody and Billy. Because there are a number of instances where Billy will say something and Jody flat out denies it.
Right.
Or Jody will say something and Billy will say, no, that was never my intention or anything I did. So, you know, it must have been some kind of juggling act of having to keep two siblings who were in the same house, who were in this cauldron of abuse and repetitive, you know, violence and injury, to have to keep all their stories straight and find, if not the absolute truth, some cohesive narrative.
Right.
And that's something I want to touch on later. But just first, the Jody and Billy, I guess, you know, figuring out who would be telling it right and who wouldn't be in the light.
Right, or at least presenting it in a manner so that I didn't want to be the final word. I only wanted to present it in a responsible way so that the reader could say, I believe this is what happened. So as much as I could, I let them speak for themselves. By the time you get to the end of the book, you see that, I mean, I think it's pretty obvious that Jody is the more credible teller of the story, because she's not trying to spring herself out of jail. You know, Billy's working on his appeal still, forever. And he needs a version of events that makes his, he needs mitigating evidence. So he provides, I think in a couple of instances they disagree about what happened, but the more common disagreement is the interpretation. And you can see the motives of either sibling in terms of what their interpretation is.
Well, just to bring it back to Billy, you had spent, I believe, six sessions with him at 3 hours each.
Mm-hmm.
And presumably, unless I'm wrong, you had not interviewed anyone face-to-face in prison before. So I just wanted to hear about what that experience is like from, you know, arranging to go to actually going out there. You also mentioned that Billy had sent a letter advising you not to wear a bra with underwire, which I'm not sure why that's the one detail that stuck out, or if that's the one
it
that
is
you
a weird little detail, because, you know, it's a man in prison talking about my underwear, which is a little weird, and yet totally pragmatic, because if I wear an underwire, then I'm not going to get through the metal detector.
So, I mean, how did you even interpret that as just, like, pragmatic advice, or is there any overtones, or did you...
I think there were other things that had some overtones, but I didn't actually think that one did. It was a little bit weird, but I didn't read anything into it, or nothing seemed to be under the surface there. my first fear was that he wouldn't see me. Or that having said he would see me, he'd change his mind and wouldn't. Because he doesn't have to. You know, you can set the whole thing up. You can show up at the prison, and if the guy doesn't want to come talk to who came to see him, he doesn't have to. So that was my major fear. Planted in my head, actually, by Jody's guardian, Thad. Because I spoke with him before I went out to see Billy, and he said, he just sort of tossed off at the end of our interview, if he even sees you, and I thought, oh my God, that hadn't occurred to me, you know, that I would go out there and he wouldn't show. So that was the anxiety that I fixed on as I was preparing to go and as I flew out there and drove to the prison. I had no idea how it was going to unfold. I didn't know if he was going to be, you know, very taciturn and refuse to answer some questions, or, you know, I'd corresponded with him before, and he was willing. I mean, he was the one who had to request to have me as a visitor. He had to fill out the forms and, you know, so that they could do the background check on me and everything. So he had been seemingly very cooperative by mail, but I really didn't know. And, you know, I'm perfectly capable, as we all know, of writing things about myself that one doesn't discuss in polite company, but I was certainly raised by people who said, you know, you don't discuss religion, you don't discuss politics, you certainly don't discuss people's sex lives. And I was going to, in defiance of all that I'd been taught, to talk to a man about murdering his family and whether or not he molested his sister and all. So I had to just sort of jump past that training, and then there's the environment of sitting in a prison visiting area with, you know, officers stalking around, and it was not like anything I'd done before. That said, Billy made it as easy as it could be. I think for two reasons. One, he wants to tell his story. He's been working on telling his story to himself and in, you know, affidavits and legal documents for the entire time that he's been in jail. He has a story and he wants somebody to listen to it. He especially wants somebody to listen to it who might have talked to his sister first because he disagrees with her. So he wants, if someone has his sister's version, he definitely wants that person to have his version. And he's really lonely. You know, he doesn't have contact with people in the outside world. So I'm sure it was really tiring. And I wouldn't let him get off topic. You know, I had those 18 hours? I had 18 hours, and I wasn't going to let him talk about movies or anything else. Not unless it pertained to what I was trying to get from him. So, and he was great. You know, we correspond still. Not something my husband relishes, but I do. He is my pen pal, I suppose, and I send him magazines and stuff every once in a while. He tried to answer all my questions. I mean, I think he showed up in good faith and gave me what he could to the best of his ability. The one problem was that he is somebody who carries this enormously toxic history. He has killed his family. And I think that he can deal with the fact that he killed his parents because they brutalized him. But he also killed his little sister, which was not part of the plan. You know, she interrupted him, he turned on her. And there's a wall around that within himself. So I think that he is dishonest about his feelings about Becky and what he did in a way that he is not consciously aware of it.
Yeah, I mean, you had described, and I guess I thought of it as the Becky problem, because I think that's even a phrase you might have used or paraphrased of, that every time you would bring it up, even under direct questioning, he would just evade it.
Yeah.
And it is. It's like, if you're constructing this narrative of how a cycle of abuse informs this terrible act of a boy killing his parents, And there's certainly legal precedent for not being convicted of first-degree murder based on, you know, previous abuse history or
right.
battered child syndrome or the like.
Right.
But then you bring Becky into the equation, who's only 11.
Changes everything.
And it does change everything.
Becky is the reason he's still in jail. Becky's the reason he didn't get manslaughter or murder too or something. He and I think he has a great deal of remorse about that. I don't think he feels remorseful about killing his parents, but I do think he feels bad about Becky. And you know, the topic is just like a wet bar of soap, you know, just like squirted out in every direction from the conversation. I couldn't hang on to it.
And yet in the book, at least, you know, from the amalgam of Jody and Billy's story, we get a sense of Becky as, you know, she's no saint. It
no.
seems like she's emulating her mother and is seen as almost a bit of a brat. So it's interesting that we think of murder victims in this sort of almost depersonalized aspect.
Right.
And certainly with Becky, what comes through is a child who can be petulant, who can be curious, but who also is snuffed out. We don't know what she's going to develop into, if
exactly.
she's going to be...
She's arrested before she becomes anything. I mean, her development ceases at 11. And I think she was a brat. In fact, what I believe happened that night was that, not what Billy says, and not necessarily what... I mean, it's sort of what I put together from various sources. She was in the bed with the mother when he bludgeoned the mother. He didn't know that. But then... he discovered that she was there. So he hustled her out of the bed really fast. She was asleep, basically, and took her up to Jody's room and said, keep her here, disappeared. Jody's asleep, she doesn't know what's going on. Becky says, you know, what do you want with me? Jody says, I don't want anything with you, I'm asleep. And so Becky says, oh, I'm going back down to Mom. Comes back down the stairs, and there is Billy, who's killed both parents, and she's trying to get to the bedroom where her mother is lying in a pool of blood. And Billy says, you know, no, go back to your own bed or go back to Jody. And she says, no. And then she gets angry and she starts, you know, trying to get past him, and they end up in some sort of physical little contretemps. And then, you know, he hits her in the head with a baseball bat. He didn't pound her in the way he attacked his father, which was, you know, evidence of just volcanic rage. I mean, he hit his father far more times. Yeah. But he did hit her because he panicked. And I have to think that at that moment in his life, he's out of his head. You know, he's in whatever strange psychic landscape you need to be in to do something like that. And you know, bludgeoning somebody with a baseball bat is not like, you know, pointing a gun across a room. It's really intimate murder. It's bad noises and blood flying out and people struggling against you. And it's, you know, the parents had defensive wounds on them that implied that they tried to fend him off. And, you know, it's a really, I don't know what landscape one is in during an act like that, but you're not in your normal head.
I mean, you've even said that this case maybe not appealed to you, but that you couldn't really envision what had happened, that it was almost unfathomable to you.
Yeah.
And I guess this is also in a way to bring up the issue of narrative, because not only is it Jody's narrative and Billy's narrative, but also your own.
Right.
And of course, you've already alluded to this a number of times in the conversation, but I sort of have to bring up your previous memoir, The Kiss, because
right.
what struck me is that there's almost a misconception that once you write about a certain topic, especially if it's a very painful topic, and it's out in the world and it gets a lot of attention and a lot of press, that door's closed and
right.
it never has to be revisited again.
Right.
But as you write in this book, if anything, it's like what happened with you and your father is the defining moment of your life. It always comes up no matter what. You're always writing
right.
about it.
Of course. You know, I mean... My response to people who say, you know, oh, there goes Katherine Harrison and she's talking about her father again. It's like, you know, hey, I'm not getting over this. You know, if you're waiting for me to get over it, it's not going to happen. And it would be very unnatural if I did get over it. Now, the form or the part that story takes in this book is of course, much less than the story of the Gillies, and it also is my connection to the story. It's one of the reasons that Jody let me write the story, because I could say to her, you know, you and I, we've been through different things, but I'm pretty sure that we are both people who have had lives that have suffered a rupture, and that, you know, there was the girl you were before that night, and there's the girl and the woman after, but there was a real severing of your life, and I believe that about myself. You know, my relationship with my father broke my life into two pieces. There was, and I think of it that way inside my head, there was before my father and after my father. And so that was one way in which I connected to the story. And the other really was that I saw aspects of myself in those children. I related to both of them. I understood Billy's rage. You can say that there was some ugly gratification for me in exploring what it was like to pound your father's head in with a baseball bat, because I am somebody who has felt murderously angry at my father. I have fantasized about killing my father, not with a baseball bat, but, you know, sort of a little bit more distantly with a gun. But, you know, I understand being that angry. And I understand Jody. I understand the sort of the good girl control freak who's going to get good grades and just manage to escape from this and put things back together. And so I got both of them in a way that made me want to tell the story, a very different story from mine, but one that I felt connected to it from the beginning.
Well, it's almost as if there was no way for you to tell this story without bringing your own story into it, and that by doing so, it's like the subjectivity makes the objective part that much more palpable, I guess,
right.
Is how I kept what I was taking away from it. Is that, you know, and that even though it's not a memoir and it's not, say, a true crime account, it's sort of its own, I guess, hybrid.
Yes, it is a hybrid.
But is that something that sort of grew organically? Was this something, I mean, you didn't sort of say, I'm going to write a book that my experiences inform this, et cetera, et cetera.
No. The first draft and the conceit that I began with was I was telling their story and I was not going to be in it. That was the idea. And that soon, you know, I looked at it, my editor looked at it, we talked about it, and we said, you know, people have to understand why you're telling this story. You know, this is a crime that occurred 20 years ago in Oregon. It's not in the news. It's happened before. There's a fresh one that you can use if you need to write this story. Why are you writing this story? You need to show your hand.
As in, why is it Catherine Harrison who's writing this story as opposed to, you know, random author person?
Right, or why is Catherine Harrison writing this story as opposed to a different story? And it was because this story resonated with my own experience. Which is why, for 10 years, I kept returning to this small amount of information that I had. Because it just caught in my brain, and I had to went back over and over it, and I needed to know why I couldn't let go of it, why it insinuated itself into my thoughts and sort of appeared apropos of nothing. So I ended up in it, and then it turned into a book that was. Well, as you know, I mean, it's a lot about the process of narrative and what narrative is and what it can do, especially in terms of narrating something that is quote-unquote unspeakable. It's about Billy telling the story of himself to himself. It's about Jody telling the story of herself to herself. It's about me telling my story of myself to myself and my telling their story and how the stories all get tangled up together, how they inform one another. And so the book became one that has passages that reconstruct the past, interspersed with passages of conversation between me and Jody and between me and Billy, where I'm trying to elicit information from them. So it's also about the process of putting a narrative together.
And that's also interesting from a more general standpoint in light of all the ink that's been spilled about memoirs in terms of truth or subjectivity or lying and the like, or somewhere in between. I mean, I guess what this book kind of brought home in a way is, you know, are we stuck too much on getting the facts right over telling a story? Are they mutually exclusive? Are they inexorably bound?
They're not mutually exclusive or inexorably bound. And I talk about this a lot because I teach memoir. And, of course, in the wake of fiascos like James Fry and Augustine Burroughs and all of it, you know, my students are always in a state of anxiety about, you know, I get things like, well, I'm not sure what color dress I was wearing when, you know, when my brother fell out of the roller coaster. And I have to say, that doesn't matter, you know. And of course, if you see a conversation on the page that took place when the writer was 7, you know that the writer wasn't standing there with a tape recorder and has transcribed it. You just, you know when your heart's in the right place. You know when you're doing your best to reveal the truth. And you're going to get a few facts wrong. But if you're actually trying to tell the truth, it's very palpable. The problem with a million... What was it, a million tiny pieces, little pieces, was that that book was obviously self-mythologizing. You know, it was about, I don't know if you read it.
Parts.
Yeah. You know,
it was hard to read once the scandal broke. What am I bringing?
Yeah, and I actually read it way before it was published because I was asked to blurb it. And, you know, it's like popcorn. You could read, you tear through it pretty fast. And I did, but I didn't blurb it. I thought, you know, this isn't a memoir. This is somebody... This is self-mythology. This is presenting oneself as the biggest, baddest drug addict ever, and you know, it was braggadocio. So I thought that book revealed itself as something that was not actually a memoir. It's interesting. One of the things that's interesting is that memoir is accused of being a narcissistic process, whereas I think a book like Fry's is a narcissistic book because it presents him in a false way that he wants other people to see him as. You know, Narcissus fell in love with his beautiful reflection on the top of the water, the surface, the beautiful surface that he wanted to see. Memoir is really about going down
into the deep
muck,
end.
You know, and digging around and seeing what weird and possibly very unappealing thing is under the surface. And memoir is about leaning toward discomfort when you're writing. It's about writing the thing you don't want to write and looking at yourself hard to see things that maybe you would prefer not to believe about yourself. And I think all of those things are completely palpable in a text. I think you can tell when somebody's doing that, and you can also tell when somebody's...
It's a question of, you know, when it rings true emotionally, I guess,
yeah.
For lack of a better term.
I also think that it's very possible to... I mean, the example that always comes to mind first is a book by Peter DeVries, who mostly wrote mysteries, but he wrote a book called The Blood of the Lamb, which was an account of his daughter dying of leukemia. And it's called a novel. You read that book and you know that's not a novel. You can pick out the pieces that aren't true. I mean, you can find the fiction in it, but the parts that are true, they just are. You feel them. They have an emotional truth that you recognize. And when you read a memoir or an autobiography and you come across a passage and you think, that didn't happen. And you just feel it. So, you know, I don't think this is a big issue. I mean, it's not something I worry about.
Well, just also in light of talking about subjectivity too, and this sort of goes back to Billy and corresponding with him, and you do mention at one point that you had helped him to subscribe to magazines and gave him money. And this is, I guess, what comes into play is because you were helping him out, even on a very small level with loans and the like, did you ever feel that what he would be answering to your questions would be a problem? Would it be compromised? Or was this not an issue?
I didn't think the content would be compromised. I think that he would have answered the questions the same way, whether or not I had given him a magazine subscription or helped him buy a pair of eyeglasses. I felt this is somebody who's going out of his way to do something hard for me, and I can make his life a little bit better out of appreciation.
It's as if his overall agenda was so big that this was a very small aspect of it.
Yeah. Is it journalistic practice to do that? Of course not. But as you say, this is sort of an odd book. It's not really journalism. It's not really memoir. It's not really true crime. It's some strange amalgam of all of those. And I talked about it, actually. I mean, I talked about it with a Random House lawyer and said, you know, I want to do this. Is that okay? And, you know, we talked about how gray the issue was in terms of this particular book and came to the conclusion that, you know, this is not, it's not like paying an informant.
And it's not like you didn't talk about it and then it was discovered later and then blown up into, you know, way out of proportion.
Right. And also he wasn't giving me information that I couldn't have dug up from other sources. He was giving me his version. All of the facts of the crime I could get from other people, but that's not what I wanted. I wanted him to tell me what he felt about it and what he thought happened. I mean, essentially, I interviewed one person after another about the same event. So it was just, you know, one layer after the other. I wasn't accessing something that I wouldn't have been able to get factually.
So, there are always multiple sources and multiple confirmations and, you know, the sense of overlap.
Right.
And just to switch gears a little bit, too, because one thing that struck me, and you do spend a bit of time on this, is to some degree Jodi's bookishness. Mm-hmm. I mean, she grows up to be a writer, but there's also a whole section about how she craves Harlequin romances.
Right.
And then another section where she talks about inexplicably, at least to her, keeping a copy of Flowers in the Attic.
Right.
Now, the Flowers in the Attic part, it seems like it's, you know, it almost would be presumptuous to, you know, trumpet this at this grand metaphor for the book in light of the contents.
Right.
But also just that this is what a girl Jodi's age would be reading at the
right.
time, too.
Of course, yeah.
But I guess I just wanted to talk a little bit about, you know, the bookishness part of her.
Well, her bookishness was one of the ways in which I felt she and I were alike. We both were kids who read a lot, not only voraciously but defensively, read in a as a way of being in a different reality. And I liked that about her. I liked that we had both arrived at the same defense. And I liked the fact that she loved literature, you know, that she grew up past Harlequin romances, and that the first time we met, we talked about The Brothers Karamazov by Dostoevsky. I mean, this was somebody who had really engaged with all sorts of interesting work to try to figure out her own self and her own life. And that was just enormously attractive to me. The Harlequin romance thing was interesting because, I'd never read one before. And sitting in Jodi's Washington, D.C. apartment and, you know, looking at her bookshelves and then having her tell me that she had this sort of obsessive relationship with Harlequin romances, I was like, what? And, you know, she's telling me that, you know, she read one after another. And then, of course, the reason for it is actually so sad and kind of, you know, just moving. You know, when she finally said, I wanted them for all the information I could get out of them, you know, things about, you know, how other people lived, and not only factual information about what it was like to live in Peru in 1950, but also so that she could have a glimpse of how normal families were supposed to have lived, you know, how what she said was how normal people treated each other, and, you know, that was heartbreaking.
What's interesting, too, is that a lot of people read romances or genre books as a means of escapism from a normal life into something extraordinary. Right. And for Jodi's case, it's the exact opposite.
Right.
Where she's using these books as a conduit towards normality.
Right, yeah. It was interesting. And also, as I said, I thought that one thing that was important for her is to just have the ability to rehearse over and over and over again the story of this heroine who manages against the odds to save herself. You know, that she's plucky, she's smart, she's got a code of ethics, she's going to be challenged, she's not going to have money, somebody's going to try to compromise her virtue, but she's going to land on her feet and she's going to be okay. And I think that was something that Jodi really needed to believe about herself. So,
and I mean, looking at it from a surface standpoint, if someone were to meet Jodi Arlington now without knowing anything about her past, which why would they? Mm-hmm. They would probably see a very accomplished, self-sufficient woman. And yet, because we don't live, nobody but Jodi Arlington lives in Jodi Arlington's head.
Right.
We have no sense of this appearance of a disconnect.
Right, right. Which is, of course, a lot of what the book is about. You know, the big disconnect between the Jodi who was Jodi Gilley and the Jodi who changed her name to Arlington very soon after the murders, embarking on her new life, giving birth to her new self.
Well, one last question for you, and this is more directed towards you, but I did wonder, as you had said, you spent 3 years on this book, and I wondered how you balanced getting immersed in this story of murder and of aftermath and of rebirth, as you talk about, with raising your own children. You have 3 children yourself.
Yeah.
And I just wondered, you know, were there any unwitting, not necessarily parallels, but just from a numerical standpoint, or just, you know, how did you go about your daily life, but also keep this story
right
circulating, and all the research and all the writing?
I am somebody who's capable of just real sort of monomania, and I believe that my family really saves me from becoming a monster. You know, I really need to have a reason to get up from my desk. You know, laundry, dinner, soccer, whatever it is. It's good for me to stop because it reestablishes some kind of balance, and it allows me to close that door on that really troubling, burdensome story. If I'm involved in it, it's not going to, you know, it has its own momentum. It's not going to go away. It's going to remain in my head. But the demands of having a family, especially, you know, having 3 kids, saves me from it. Saves me from myself. So I've always been really grateful for that balance in my life that I couldn't create for myself any other way. I can't say it's 5 o'clock, it's time to stop and get up. I would just be sitting there. You know, I should get up, I would be tired, but I wouldn't be able to do it for myself. So I'm not sure, did I answer the question that you asked or not really? You know, it was in some ways the hardest book I've ever written because of the content. I remember there was a point Jodi and I were visiting the victim services counselor, Connie Skillman, who helped her right after the murders. And, you know, she's somebody that Jodi was quite close to and remains in touch with. And Jodi said to her, and this is early in the research, I was only about 6 months into it, and Jodi said to Connie, she said, I'm so relieved by this process, you know, that Catherine's doing this. I just feel like this whole burden has slid off my shoulders. I mean, literally feel lighter.
Why you are free and I'm here freezing. And how many times were you hurting inside with the lights on? Bulb in your head, put your worries to bed. If you're frightened, you can try counting sheep.